advise how you can be helpful and how you can be helped. Most people who you'll meet may be willing to help you and make connections, but they won't know who may help your career. Also, if you're open to sharing your expertise, be specific and explain what you have to offer. By being open about it and communicating clearly, you increase your chances of making meaningful connections. Living unconventionally comes at a cost. Since you're listening to this book, you're probably a self-declared nonconformist or on your way to becoming one. I noticed I was living unconventionally when I turned 17 and got my first job. I was a news anchor at a local TV station in my hometown in Poland and was earning a nice salary. To this day, I can say that this was probably the best job I had ever had. But back then, my joy was overshadowed by the fact that I felt different. My classmates' first jobs were bagging groceries or flipping burgers, so being a journalist felt like an outcast. I felt I constantly had to downplay how great being a journalist was. I was meeting many people, getting freebies, being invited to press events, but the gap between my friends and I kept widening, being fed by my TV adventure. It was as if my unconventional job was exposing me to a different language, which I was soaking in, but which was only echoed by the walls of the TV studio. No one understood me. It was all glamorous, yet I had nobody to share it with. Through the years, my life has become even more infused with unconventional opinions, experiences, careers, and lifestyle. The discomfort tied to living my unconventional life sets in, and fear of sounding arrogant makes me want to reframe, omit, or just not share details, or at least add that it all has its drawbacks too. Living unconventionally comes with its territory, and here is what you may feel. You are a misfit. As glamorous as your lifestyle sounds, if you're a travel writer taking off months at a time, a singer who gets to tour the world doing what you love, or a business owner who works remotely, there are going to be times when you'll feel you can't relate to anyone, which may lead to feeling inadequate. You have no right to complain. When you have a bad day, you may get shut down with a sarcastic comment reminding you that your unconventional life is so great that you don't have the right to feel off. You have to downplay reality. You find yourself constantly talking about the downsides of your lifestyle, explaining that it's not that great. You focus on dissatisfaction. Being not understood can make you feel dissatisfied and not being able to fully enjoy your unconventional lifestyle. You feel alone. Not being able to fully share your life because you have to downplay it, being shut down, and not being on the same wavelength can make you feel lonely. You feel not heard. The stories you share may be so different from your peers that they may be perceived as too weird to tune in. Living unconventionally comes at a cost. By being aware of it, we can start building our unconventional shield. Understanding that unconventional life gets unconventional reactions will make us forego striving for understanding, acceptance, and approval, and let us accept the life we are living. Right time to start your creative career. Beginnings and transitions are scary. You may be tempted to postpone starting your creative career indefinitely because you like the predictable comfort of the status quo. You may think there's still time for change, and your fear of unknown can be too paralyzing to take action. You've heard the advice that the time is now, and that you should have started yesterday. All this may add to the discomfort. The time is now for those who had taken necessary steps to get ready. Starting or transitioning into your creative career doesn't begin with your transitioning, but with you getting ready for it. Self-discovery work, research, and meetings with those who already have your dream career are all parts of your transition, and the more diligent you are about completing the steps, the smoother your transition will be. Preparation will reinforce your decision, making you less ready to reconsider your decisions. Getting ready will build a solid foundation for your new career. You won't be wobbling, but striding confidently through the process of change. Here are helpful tools you may need to execute your transition plan. Planner and productivity apps. you'll need a system to keep track of your transition progress. Whether you're attracted to a system that sets out 100 days to achieve a goal and want to get the Mastery Journal by John Lee Dumas, or you're into colors and stickers and want to buy one of the Erin Condren planners, choose a system that will work for you. A planner and an app will hold you accountable. You'll be able to create daily checklists, collecting the check marks or stickers, not wanting to break the sticker chain. This will contribute to making sure you're consistent in your preparation efforts. Accountability partners. Join a group, hire a coach, or find a partner who will be holding you accountable of your transformation progress. Strong reason. Whether it's your unbearable status quo or the mission behind your products, find what really drives your transition and let it lead you through the process. These are actions worth taking when you start getting ready for your transition. Contact people who have the career you'd like to transition into. These don't have to be only the people you know. Reach out on social media, look through LinkedIn job descriptions, read interviews, and contact these creatives, asking them directly what steps you need to take, what the roadblocks are, what they like about what they do, and what they had to sacrifice for it. Accomplished people you'll be contacting are probably very busy. In Chapter 11, I'll be going over efficient ways to contact busy professionals. Equipped with the information from reaching out to creatives, make an action plan with steps you need to take to get there. Be very specific and make sure the steps of your plan are small. Do you need to do research, acquire skills, learn from online tutorials, sign up for a course? Take a class or join a group. There is so much information available for you out there. You just have to find it. When you execute your action plan, it's important to stay curious and open. Not every step you take will be useful in your transition progress, so it's crucial to get a start on the process with an accepting mind. Discovery process may make you reshape your dream and steer your transition path in a more fitting direction if you just keep taking consistent action. Your turn. Reflect, discuss, journal. What can keep you committed through the whole process of making it? What is the winning attitude to succeed? What's stopping you? What do you have to be putting up with because of your limiting beliefs? What have you been missing out on because you haven't been stepping into your greatness? Creative career insight. Wear your too large wings with confidence. You'll grow into them. 3. Exploring creativity within.
The real voyage of discovery consists not in seeking new landscapes, but in having new eyes. Marcel Proust, in The Search of Lost Time. In the ideal world, we would be able to create with abandon, draw with large strokes, take risks, and explore with courage limitless possibilities available to us. We would create the way we dance when no one is watching. We all know that dance, a carefree, fun, joyful dance that makes us truly happy. When we create, uncertainty, doubt, and fear sneak into our minds, changing our attitude and putting our ideas into a box with rigid walls reinforced by criticism. We're so afraid to be wrong that our creativity becomes iterations of what already exists. These self-accepted boundaries are letting us be original, but not to the point of being weird. Weird is outside the box. Blue sky thinking, or thinking outside the box, have become popular expressions to encourage our creative freedom. But if we were truly free to create, no one would have to give it a name. Most successful creatives are alchemists who are able to blend self-doubt, criticism, and risk into a powerful creative juice and start making things as if no one was watching. Finding what inspires you. Inspiration, just like other amazing things in life, happens when you don't expect it. You can't plan to get inspired. However, you could always be open and ready for it. If you're planning a beach vacation to do some thinking, get inspired, and make some business decisions, you may be disappointed. You may discover that during your time off, you'll want to do nothing. It may be too hot and noisy to get inspired. Your creative mind might not like the environment. It's possible that you discover that a beachfront cottage is actually less inspiring than a crowded subway platform in your hometown, where the energy of everyone rushing somewhere is stimulating. It's common to think that once you get all things completed and out of the way, you'll get creative. However, depending on what inspires you, you may need the inspiration entourage, other things and projects which are unrelated to the main action of your focus. What inspires us is personal. For an entrepreneur, it may be stimulating to read about a successful company following its startup process from the beginning to its prosperous stages. Regardless of the area of our expertise, reading about business growth processes and the career paths of others can be motivating. Reading books, blogs, and articles may trigger a new strategy in your current venture or spark an unexpected idea in you, which may be the start of a side hustle of business. You can hear examples of businesses started alongside day jobs on the daily podcast Side Hustle, created by Chris Guillebeau. These stories can inspire you to implement new tactics or make a commitment to starting a venture. It's best to treat these side hustle examples as inspiration and not as something to mimic because our circumstances may be completely different. Also, do keep in mind that any business may seem more exciting and easier than yours just because it's new and we don't know what running it entails. Power of implicit inspiration. One of my favorite pastimes is reading about successful entrepreneurs. There's something intriguing about the full process of starting and succeeding in business, regardless of the area. I'll read about a startup that came up with a spice mix for cooking fish and analyze their prices and packaging design. I'll check out their website and read the story about how the business started. Such entrepreneurial stories, even though often not directly related to what I do, are very inspirational. It's through this implicit inspiration that the best ideas happen. As a designer, I do get inspired by seeing jewelry exhibits and other artists' work, but also when I look at clothes, follow fashion trends, and listen to my customers. There's something about complete detachment and exposure to the unknown that equips us with courage and ideas to create while traveling. Every day is an invitation to its dance. E.B. White about Henry David Thoreau. The colors of an Indian sari, details in Hindu temples, smells of spices, can all create an image to be transferred from our mind onto a canvas as a painting, onto a piece of paper as a journal entry, into a necklace, or as a beautiful photograph. It's up to us what we'll do with the beautiful imprint in our minds. Inspiration is everywhere around us. It can flutter in the wings of a Sri Lankan butterfly, or you can find it sitting in the comfort of your couch, listening to the monotony of the rain. By being open, you're taking it all in. Elizabeth Gilbert, in her TED Talk, Your Elusive Creative Genius, mentions fairies who follow people around rubbing fairy juice on their projects and stuff. She encourages us to take the pressure off and not think we are the only ones responsible for the outcome of our creative process. We need to be more forgiving toward ourselves, do our best, and recognize that our imagination contributes to the utter maddening capriciousness of the creative process. By detaching ourselves from the results of our work, we'll stop expecting unimaginable results and start being creative in our own ways. Feeling this freedom of expression will stop experiencing writer's block. This reassurance of being enough will put us in the blissful flow of creation. Power of implicit learning. Why do I have to learn math beyond a multiplication table? You may hear kids wondering all over the world. Children drop out of high school or college because they think they can use their time better than deepening their knowledge in classrooms. Subjects offered at schools seem futile to them. I don't want to be a mathematician, complaints continue. Being exposed to many successful college dropout stories, which made quitting school acceptable, many parents support their children in their decision not to continue formal education. After giving it some thought, parents realize that during their careers, they didn't need to use any math other than multiplication tables or percentage calculation. Often, they start supporting their child in dropping out of school, thinking that he can make a better use of his time than studying advanced math, biology, history, etc. Unfortunately, often this child becomes a burden to their parents. He dreams of starting a business but doesn't have enough business acumen and is not inspired. Well-roundedness, a foundation of knowledge, and inspiration are developed at school, which he dropped out of. You'll notice when you directly use the knowledge you acquired at school, but it's harder to spot its indirect usage. What we had learned shaped us and our ability to deduct, solve problems, and interpret. We have been learning implicitly.
A lifetime of learning can be a success in itself, Theodore Roosevelt.
A lot of people have a hard time believing in implicit learning as the connection is difficult to notice. The correlation between successful problem solving and having taken a math class is not easy to prove. It's also hard to measure which class, if any at all, contributed to the skill. It's easier to think about learning in a more direct way. Knowing your multiplication table is only related to you being able to multiply. Proponents of explicit learning will only tie specific subjects to specific outcomes. They have more of a vocational school mentality. You learn the parts of cars and how cars work to be a car mechanic. However, if the aspiring car mechanic goes to college, he may want to own an auto repair shop and hire car mechanics. College may instill in him the desire to grow, implementing strategies and systems, and he'll become professionally driven. Education, no matter at what level, inspires curiosity and growth, contributing to professional fulfillment. The comparison of the life of a school dropout with the life of the school graduate is unfair due to other variables unrelated to school, such as personality, talent, determination, etc. Let's take film directors as an example. You'll find some very successful directors like Steven Spielberg, who didn't go to film school, or those who didn't go to college at all. David Fincher, director of Gone Girl, The Social Network, and The Curious Case of Benjamin Button, graduated only from high school. If you search well, you'll definitely find some examples of successful people from different walks of life who dropped out of high schools or colleges. However, we will never know where these people would be now had they finished high school or college. Schools give us immeasurable exposure to knowledge and inspiration that we are unaware of. That precious knowledge will pop up unexpectedly in our life, regardless if we find its link or connection. Reframing criticism. I keep reminding myself and entrepreneurs who experience business growth that fame comes with the territory. We may think that expanding our company will simply mean doing what we've been doing so far, but on a higher level. We often don't realize that, alongside of more exposure and more opportunities, we will be dealing with unexpected disadvantages of being known. All of a sudden, we'll have haters. Those who, once we became known, started paying attention to us and dissecting what we say or do, carefully watching if we trip, trying to make us fall. Fame and business growth is not for those who seek everyone's approval. If your goal is to make sure that everyone likes you, you may consider owning a small business, a very small business, actually. Think of a neighborhood mom-and-pop store or another lifestyle business that is known locally. Even then, you are running the risk of not pleasing everyone or stumbling upon someone who criticizes you because he wants to feel better about himself.
Criticism, like rain, should be gentle enough to nourish a man's growth without destroying his roots.
Frank A. Clark. Let's look into the video series, Celebrities Read Mean Tweets. Every time Jimmy Kimmel's crew posts one of them online, it goes viral. Each one of them has millions of views. The series is one of the most watched videos on his YouTube channel. Clicking on them, we can watch celebrities reading the meanest things about themselves, from death wishes to harshest critiques of their looks, age, and talent. Seeing the popularity of mean tweet videos, producers created Reading Mean Tweets, NFL Edition. There's even an edition featuring Barack Obama reading harsh things about himself. Why is there such fascination with reaching out for the sharpest tools to hurt others? And why is there an audience choosing to watch, read, and experience this? We could dissect psychological reasons for this, but this is not the objective of this book. The point here is to show you that those who hate and criticize do exist and are not going anywhere. People who criticize online come in masses. Internet trolls are bold. They enter their own contest of who can provide the wittiest, harshest comments. The responses of desperate targets feed the fire, generating more animosity and hate. Since trolls post anonymously, they have no fear of showing their meanest side. It's doubtful they would ever say those critiques directly to someone. It's as if the anonymity on the internet gave them permission to act differently. I'm writing about criticism to try to get us ready for it, to make us realize that it's there to stay. We can't control it, but we can control how we react to it. Successful creatives equip themselves with a shield, practice detachment, or try looking at it from a different perspective. Looking into anger displacement in psychology, you may suspect that most critiques are probably a reaction to an unrelated upsetting event that must have happened earlier. It's not a justification for trolling behavior, but it may be a helpful reminder to practice detachment. By shifting perspective, we may be able to extract some positive feedback from criticism. Practicing killing with kindness is best, but second best is not being reactive, remembering that our comments may only aggravate the situation. It's not about seeking justice and winning the exchange. It's about preserving our positive morale and continuing creating successfully. Those who keep the big picture in mind and let go of the minutiae they can't control will continue living life by design. Avoiding creative block. Creative block is the feeling of your mind going blank when you try to start a sketch, another chapter of your book, a proposal that's due, or anything else with a submission deadline. The more you stare at an empty page or screen, the more you can't figure out how to continue. You start daydreaming and the process becomes forced and stressful. What surprises me is that many people keep trying to create sitting at the same table in the same position, the environment where they had such a tough time creating things. When I realized that rooms with freshly cleared desks were not helping my creativity, I started changing my writing locations. Because I was stumbling upon most of my ideas when I was in movement, I made sure I always had a notebook with me. I get a lot of writing ideas when I bike. I have to keep stopping and writing notes on my phone. It can happen that I write at a parking lot by a supermarket where I'm going to next. If I have an idea but not much time available, I still take out my laptop and start writing. There's never too little time when you're inspired to write. If you're driving and a great idea comes to your mind, park your car and start writing. Even if you only have 15 minutes, this short time can be more valuable than the few hours that you were planning to spend creating at your desk. Don't waste any time when you get inspired to make things. Creating is like buying a gift. In order to get the perfect gift for someone, you should keep your eyes open for it. It's not the same if you wait until you allocate time for gift shopping. You're then pressed to buy it. The chances of getting a great gift are much higher if you open yourself up to just stumbling upon it. When you're trying to create at your desk at the same time that you blocked, the pressure is there. Try having your laptop or notebook with you whenever you can, and be open to write when you get inspired no matter how little time you have. Many creatives don't make as much progress as they would like to because they are convinced they should be blocking chunks of time to design or write. Work, family obligations, and life in general do get in the way of having extended amounts of time devoted exclusively to creating. Realizing the benefits of working creatively for as little as 20 minutes will bring us closer to completion. I'm not saying that you should not block chunks of time and devote it to creating. My suggestion would be to do both. Block the time to create and also create when the inspiration strikes. Wherever you can, and no matter for how long. One of the ways of making sure that you continue writing consistently is to keep some type of a scorecard. Because writing doesn't provide immediate gratification, usually we have to wait for months, if not years, before seeing our work published, it's important to create our own gratification system. Keeping score of the amount of words written or the time you spend writing will create an internal contest with yourself. You'll be motivated to keep up, surpass yourself, but most importantly, to continue.
Writer's block is the equivalent of impotence. It's the performance pressure you put on yourself that keeps you from doing something you naturally should be able to do.
Neil Strauss. We often experience a creative block simply because the standards we set for ourselves are too high, which gives us performance anxiety. We sabotage our creativity by expecting perfection, being afraid to even start because of the incompetence we feel.
The first draft of anything is shit, says Ernest Hemingway.
Accepting it and taking the pressure off of ourselves may be one of the most important procrastination-conquering tools we can apply. Being invested in every little step of the process, instead of constantly dwelling upon the results, may lead to progress and pure enjoyment of every piece of our big picture. Soon you'll notice what works for you. Trying methods to see what fits your personality and lifestyle is an important part of committing to living life by design.
Woman with her back to the ocean view.
I arrived at a beautiful ashram in California. Little windy paths were leading me to different huts, a dining hall, a yoga studio, and a library. The zen of this place was intensified by its amazing location on the beach with breaking waves. I found the reception office, which was right on the ocean. To my surprise, when I entered the space, a woman sitting there had her back turned to the ocean view. After I checked in, I asked her why she wasn't facing the ocean. "No way, I wouldn't be able to get anything done," she said. I'm actually not surprised. I've stayed and lived in a few oceanfront places in my life, and I couldn't agree more. Serenity of the ocean may be motivating to some, but to others, a mesmerizing view may be too hypnotic to inspire productivity. You may have a romantic idea of creatives working in chalets in the mountains or secluded cabins in the woods. Upon having done some exploration, it was interesting to find out that many writers create on trains and planes. Emily St. John Mandel, author of Station 11, often writes on the subway during her two-hour daily commute. Alexander Chi, author of The Queen of the Night, writes on trains a lot, and his ideal place to have an office would be in an Amtrak cafe car. Peter Shankman flies more than 250,000 miles a year and does most of his writing in transit. He has a plane writing routine and apps that help him focus for 15 hours. Using software such as OhmWriter, which transfers your laptop screen into a distraction-free, sparkling white display, and not eating on flights, Shankman creates the most creativity-inviting environment. On one of his recent air trips, he was able to write over 28,000 words, which included finishing three chapters of his book faster than normal. Waiting for the iconic settings to create, you may be bound for disappointment. Try exploring various environments to work from and discover which works best for you. Catalyzing your creativity. We often think that to be more creative, we need to come up with more things. New things excite us. We can't seem to find any motivation in reworking and revising what we've already created. There is a great value in deeply appreciating what we've made and expanding on the process. If we move on from what we've completed way too soon, we deprive clients from knowing about it and owning it. We call it old stock, last year designs. But why don't we pay attention to our customers who may want vintage? Being creative doesn't only mean making new things. It's also creating more efficient strategies and processes in our business. You can catalyze your creativity by reinventing, but how about reinvigorating? It's like falling in love with your products and business again, but differently. You love them for staying relevant and classic instead of novel and breakthrough. It did help that years ago we stopped saying old and used and rebranded it into vintage. All of a sudden, repurposing became a fad, and used clothing and refurbished furniture stores started blooming. We keep wasting time watching what else is out there, trying to mimic our idols instead of getting inspired and minding our business. We get so distracted by following the popular belief that creativity equals novelty that we keep getting off course. We forget what's important to us and why we started doing what we're doing in the first place. Do we want to grow our business or grow the number of products we offer, which doesn't necessarily equal to growth? Do we want to amass likes on social media or focus on engagement with our true fans? How we spend our creative energy is fluid, so let's look into our potential, revisit our goals, and readjust our efforts. Boosting your creativity. There are no creativity-stimulating methods that work for everyone. We may think that having a tidy desk will be like owning a blank canvas ready for our creative juices to start flowing, but numerous studies prove otherwise. Mikhail Cho, in his article about how clutter affects brain, says, "A clean desk can be seen as a dormant area, an indication that no thought or work is being undertaken." Controlled mess has many other proponents. David H. Friedman and Eric Abrahamson, authors of A Perfect Mess, are among those who claim that moderately disorganized people are more creative and more effective than those who are organized. If a cluttered desk is a sign of a cluttered mind, of what, then, is an empty desk? Albert Einstein. Those who go to cafes to work creatively may benefit from the background noise. The phenomenon of working from a favorite coffee shop has been popularized by a great number of writers, including Ernest Hemingway and F. Scott Fitzgerald, who worked from cafes at the turn of the 20th century. A journal article from Oxford University Press explores the effects of ambient noise on creativity. The study finds that moderate noise, about 70 decibels, can enhance our performance on creative tasks. We experience this level when exposed to the background music or conversations in restaurants. This may explain the attraction of creatives to working from cafes and other communal places. Malcolm Gladwell wrote most of his book, Blink, from the Savoy Restaurant in Manhattan. He even mentioned the place in acknowledgments. Here's how he described the experience of writing in Savoy with the windows open. "You feel the traffic. You feel in the middle of things, and paradoxically, I find it very calming." Dimming the lights is yet another creativity-boosting method worth trying. According to a recent research in the Journal of Environmental Psychology, our cognitive performance improves in low-lit spaces. Dim lighting creates an environment free from constraints and distractions where our minds can internally reflect and focus. One additional creativity tip is to get tipsy. The article, Uncorking the Muse, shows us the difference in problem-solving between sober and intoxicated participants of a study. It's important to mention that intoxicated meant with the blood alcohol content of 0.075, which equals to having had about one glass of wine. Moderate alcohol consumption contributed to faster and more insightful problem-solving. It's worth becoming familiar with these research results to evaluate which studied creativity boosters you're going to adapt to stimulate your productivity. Ultimately, it's for you to create the environment you thrive in. Your turn. Reflect, discuss, journal. What's the environment where you thrive creatively? How can you reinvigorate your business? What is your constructive way to deal with criticism? Creative career insight. Get exposed to the unknown. It will equip you with courage and ideas to create. 4. Transforming from artist into creative entrepreneur. The starting point of all achievement is desire. Napoleon Hill, Think and Grow Rich. Even though most of us believe that a transformation takes years to happen, the actual change process happens usually very fast. What takes time is arriving at that moment of push and discomfort that creates in us the need to change. Don't wait for the appropriate moment to begin your transition into creative entrepreneur. Just like the decision of having a child and your feeling of never being ready, no time may feel like the right moment to start a business or make a transition. Once you feel that drive, that true inspiration, start the process and persevere. Let that passion guide the unstoppable you. Many describe making that transition as making a leap, However, successful creative entrepreneurs are aware that making that leap wasn't a standalone process. There are a multitude of activities, lessons, experiences, and decisions prior to the leap that prepared us for the change. We may not realize that the leap is actually a walk on a path which we have been creating. Often we are already immersed in the change-making process, but realize only the final stage of the happening shift. That's usually when we physically do something. Move, quit a job, get on a plane, or say yes to your spouse at your wedding ceremony. Saying yes, quitting cold turkey, making a leap, all these transformations got their start long before we made the actual physical change. The early stages of transformation may not be detectable. The first sparks may have appeared during our travels or conversations with our loved ones. Back then, we didn't make any decisions. We may not have even noticed that the transformation seed had been planted in us. We feed these sparks with thoughts, information, and education until they become flames that grow in us. We then have a choice to either do nothing and extinguish them or make the leap. Beginning before being ready. A lot of new entrepreneurs spend months having endless brainstorming sessions about the name of the business, then researching patents, deciding on incorporating the company or making it an LLC, choosing the company colors, building a website, designing and printing their business cards. By the time they're done with the setup, they may lose the precious initial momentum that every business owner has. There's only little energy left to be spent on what's most important for the business, testing and customer acquisition. By the time the tedious setup is done, all that the owner feels like doing is sitting by the phone and waiting for it to ring. He was ready to reach out, call, network, connect when he was excited initially, but now the business seems like an old story and he is not excited talking about it anymore. Testing doesn't get enough energy either, not to mention it's now too late to test. There is so much time, effort, and resources spent on setting up the business that it would feel bad to turn around and give up. The main advantage of testing your product is it increases the odds of it being successful. Chris Guillebeau went on a multi-city tour for his book, Born for This. During the tour and multiple talks he gave, he realized that the audience was interested in the topic of starting side businesses. When the majority of the questions his readers would ask him were about being an entrepreneur on the side, he took it as a sign and started looking into it further. Chris started writing the book Side Hustle and committed to recording a daily podcast called The Side Hustle School. All he did was listen to his audience in multiple cities, expressing interest in starting a business on the side. He started a business being reassured that there's interest, that there will be buyers. The reason why so many businesses fail is the fact that the owner's original passion is not sustainable. Consistency, passion consistency in particular, is one of the key elements of contributing to entrepreneurial success. Striving for perfection had done more harm than good, especially in the world of entrepreneurship. Many people fail to achieve originality because they generate a few ideas and then obsess about refining them to perfection. Adam Grant, Originals. Before I started Lucid New York, I had a glass jewelry line. I started making and selling glass jewelry designs shortly after I took a few classes at a local glass studio in Brooklyn, Urban Glass. I wasn't ready. I didn't have a business. I was making glass jewelry pieces and noticed that people wanted to buy them, so I simply started selling them, making up prices on the go. With time, I did some research and started coming up with systems. I even came up with a name, Anna Glass. I'm convinced that the reason why I was able to build a momentum and sell a lot of glass jewelry was because I started acting on it immediately. I had jewelry and people wanted to buy it, so I started selling it. There are many budding entrepreneurs who worry too much about the structure of the business and they are afraid they won't be conforming with the law if they start selling. Registering a business is less complicated than you think, and in most cases, it's safe to assume that you can always decide about the structure once you start generating income. Danger of looking for an always bigger cushion. Cushions are soft, comfortable, and predictable. We can learn and rest on them. Ideally, we would all like to have a big cushion before starting our transition. $1 million in the bank or a supportive spouse to fall back on if things go wrong. We all love cushions. However, transitions often don't happen because we're searching for an even bigger cushion. The one that was big enough before scares us now. It's too small. We now need a bigger cushion to fall back on and feel comfortable. The dark, what-if scenarios and statistics scare us and stop us from moving and changing. For the 14 years that I have had my jewelry business, I've always heard people complaining about the economy. The economy has been blamed for failures and businesses that never started. Waiting for the economy to get better became another reason for procrastinating and not launching. And yet so many successful businesses started in unfavorable economic conditions. Another excuse is looking at others around us who also are not taking risks. They give us reassurance because they're just like us. They continue their status quo life as if they were dancing to some music and they couldn't stop. They didn't choose the music. They just made a few dancing steps, and now that life is a leader as they follow its steps. They don't even hear the music. They keep dancing without noticing if they like the song. Most of us are waiting for the understanding of others. We would like others to transition before us and reassure us. We wait until we realize that we are alone with our decisions. Everybody's situation is different, and everyone's entrepreneurial path very individual. And if we wait for others to transition first and be our cushion, we may never launch. Your transformation is like a revolution, and all the excuses make it easy to postpone its start. Timing may never be right. Not being ready is always a problem. It may seem that you need a certain amount of money to start a business, a quiet chalet with an ocean view to start writing a book, or a thriving economy before taking the first step. Stop listening to others. Instead, hear yourself and act on when your inspiration comes. Start writing your book on your phone, in line at a breakfast place waiting for your omelet. Start your business when the first person asks you if you made your purse and it's for sale. Say yes and make up a price. Take the handbag off your shoulder and sell it. You can always make another bag. Grab that energy and passion in you and act on it. Don't postpone it. Your revolution time is now. Timing, early versus right. In 2003, my friend Nate and I bought the domain thereshiis.com, which seemed like a perfect business name for a model portal we wanted to create. Back then, I was working as a project manager, so all our startup work had to be done in the evenings during the week or on weekends. It was tough because my full-time job was demanding. We were doing it, though. Nate designed the website, and we had meetings to brainstorm about our target market, the website content, the revenue model, and all the other stuff small businesses have to make decisions about. It was exciting. We wanted thereshiis.com to be a virtual meeting place for models and photographers. Models would post their portfolios, photographers could browse and hire, and we would post jobs available. Both Nate and I were overwhelmed by the idea. We didn't feel reassured and comfortable with the concept of community sites because they were not popular yet. Facebook wasn't around yet. It was hard to be an early pioneer in the category. We didn't know if we were going in the right direction. We both had very demanding full-time jobs, and neither of us was courageous enough to pull the trigger and get the company going. It seemed there was always something left to be done. Our to-do list kept growing, pushing our launch date into the future. The initial startup energy was slowly being replaced by uncertainty and exhaustion. There She Is never launched. We ran out of the initial excitement, and we were intimidated by being one of the only few in the social portal category. Just a year later, ModelMayhem.com started. I remember when I first saw the site. I frantically looked through the Model Mayhem pages, seeing our There She Is idea beautifully executed. It's as if the business we had worked so hard on finally launched, but yet under a different name and we were not the owners. Being early may not always be a winning strategy in business. 6 years ago, I introduced rose gold vermeil jewelry into the Lucid New York line. The pieces were not well received because they were too novel and customers were not used to seeing rose gold in department stores or at Tiffany's. A few years later, Michael Kors introduced rose gold plated watches, which became widely popular. Tiffany's and other prestigious retailers started selling rose gold jewelry as well. I then started getting inquiries about rose gold jewelry. Customers wanted to get some pieces complementing their rose gold watches. A celebrity or a global brand can be first and introduce a trend. For the rest of us, it's safer to watch what they're doing and join the already introduced trends. It's safer and also cheaper, because those mogul brands usually found a lot of national reach advertising. We can ride the wave of this exposure and greatly benefit from the category being popularized on someone else's budget. Entrepreneurs need to appease their ego that wants to be first and invent. Instead of entering early, focus on entering the market mindfully and at the right time. Being visionary with a system. A lot of creatives may have a strong vision, but because it's not backed up by a system, the idea may never get executed. Some artists hope that someone will do all the background implementation work for them. They feel that they have come up with the idea and this should be enough. Their work is done and someone else should do the rest. They may even claim that artists create and business people implement the systems. They may even convince themselves that they're not good at marketing and other idea execution areas. These creatives may choose to spend their time looking for an agent, or worse yet, wait and see what happens. The danger of passing time and passion fading may make staying motivated and driven toward the idea more difficult. If the initial excitement and being in the flow of creation is not there anymore, we may get tempted by excitement of the new concept to move on from the old idea and start another project. This process of creating unexecuted visions may continue on if we let it. Creatives need to understand that putting the systems in place may sometimes be more important than the originality of the idea itself. In simple terms, a system is a set of answers to the question, what are you going to do with your product? Here are the components of the system. Distribution. Decisions around selling your product. Where are you going to sell? Who are you going to target? How are you going to ship, deliver? Pricing. Decisions around pricing your products. What value are you providing? One of a kind, popular, inexpensive, rare, quantity, superior quality. What's your cost? How are you going to set your price based on the above? Positioning. Decisions about where your products belong. Imagine a shelf where your products are displayed. What's around your product? Where, how should your product be displayed? Cost-effective production. Know the exact costs of producing and reproducing your products. Do include cost of materials, labor, expenses, and do add at least 10% accounting for mistakes, unsold merchandise, waste, unpredictable expenses. Product entourage. Post-purchase support, returns, exchanges, warranty, packaging, discounts, and promotions. In order to create a successful system, we should make sure it is replicable. You are able to recreate the system. Agile. You are able to tweak the system based on circumstances. Efficient. You can automatically move in between the steps. One of the reasons why there's a coined term of a starving artist is because some creatives don't think about the systems. They just make things and wait on what happens. You need a system to have a successful creative career, unless you want to continue having a creative hobby. Using Stephen Pressfield's terms of amateurs and pros from The Work of Art, amateurs are visionaries. Pros are visionaries with a system. Stigma of wanting to make money. I want to start this business because it's my passion, said a coaching client of mine during one of our sessions. But truth be told, he added, I'm starting it because I need to make money. But of course, I'm not supposed to say that. I listened to his reasoning, realizing that us entrepreneurs are conditioned by society to talk about passion, drive, good causes as reason to start a business, but the subject of money as a motivation stays taboo. Most business owners pretend that money is not important to them. Meanwhile, their companies often provide their only source of income. When I suggested to my client that it was okay to admit that he was launching the business to make money, he seemed relieved. I started wondering why money evoked such negative feelings. Usually, big fortunes are associated with selfishness and dishonesty. We quiet down our feelings of unhealthy enviousness by reasoning that those who amassed wealth are greedy, thinking only about themselves and got rich using fraudulent means. However, looking at money from a positive perspective, it's safe to assume that we don't usually like to make money just to amass it for no reason. We plan on spending it on us, our families, and on causes we believe in to make the world a better place. We help, share, and get educated. By improving our lives, we improve the life of others. Looking at money from this perspective, we realize that often it's not a focus, but our means to achieve higher goals. Artists are often ashamed to charge money. They consider the cost of materials, canvas, paints, and brushes, and feel guilty charging a premium price for their pieces. Most of them feel that if they talk about business and money, they will feel like sellouts. Since they started making art, creatives have been told that making art is about love, true calling, passion, and money will come with it. Making money always seemed natural and effortless. However, nowadays, when becoming an artist and sharing work is so easy, only those talented creatives who focus on profit will stop starving. Making it a priority is the only way to make our business sustainable. We've all heard about the low statistics of small business survival. Creatives making art have a choice: setting adequate prices and focusing on making profits, or joining the statistics of the small businesses that fail. Money is one of the measures of how successful our business is. It shows us if people find our services and products valuable and if they are willing to pay for them. When we see what sells, we can base our future strategic decisions on it and grow our business. Another reason why we need to get rid of the stigma behind money is the fact that most entrepreneurs run their businesses full-time, so it's their only way to generate income. Many business owners rely on loans and spouses to support them. Usually, this solution is only temporary. We all need money to live, and running businesses that aren't profitable is not sustainable. It's time to let go of the stigma and embrace money as a reason to start a business. It's okay to strive to have a profitable business and make it a priority. This will lead to creating a healthy and sustainable company in line with our values. It's not about the idea, it's about execution. A lot of people obsess about the novelty of their ideas and keeping them secret. Before even starting a business, they're worried that they may get copied. This obsession of not being copied gets in the way of being creative, as creativity is all about sharing and getting influenced. Most of us are not inventors. We create influence by what's already out there, and whether we want to admit it or not, we follow. I've had circle necklaces in my collection for years. Every now and then, I would get a comment from a customer saying that these necklaces look like the collection of another designer. Guess what? Almost every successful jewelry designer makes circle necklaces. That's what people like and buy. I'm not going to make ovals just to be different. I follow what's trendy and what people buy. Celebrities could probably make ovals and they'd become popular, but I prefer to safely follow what's already out there. I can guarantee that even if celebrities started making oval necklaces, there's already someone out there who had made them before. Everything has been done. Let's stop obsessing about being first in the category. It does happen to a few, but this status of an inventor doesn't guarantee success. Most businesses make stuff that's already out there. Let's focus on the stellar execution of the idea instead. Entrepreneurs get very excited when they come up with an idea. I love listening to them being giddy, drawing and explaining how they're about to rule the world. I think this drive and excitement is crucial to success, so I'm never the one to extinguish their fire. However, I do think that many entrepreneurs get excited too early. It should come after the idea is executed. It's not about having ideas. It's about how you bring them to life. Emotional detachment from your business. Many artists focus on the first step, the idea, which often doesn't get executed and remains a dream. These creatives think that success will just happen to them. They act as inventors and makers of one-of-a-kind creations, which are often not perceived as commercially viable. Sometimes they dangerously fall in love with their products, not wanting to part with them or not being motivated to create a distribution system to sell them. This emotional attachment to the business can be risky and can hurt growth. Overly attached creatives may get too one-dimensional and removed from reality, not grasping the big picture. Emotional detachment is crucial if you want to scale your business and succeed. It's also important not to get overly attached to results. If a creative spends a long time on a project and it is unsuccessful, it's time to reevaluate. However, it's more important to find enjoyment in every step of the process so that we don't get discouraged by the lengthy execution process. If we detach ourselves from the results, we will be able to run our business mindfully. Obsession and passion will be replaced by focusing on consistency and achieving work and life balance. Being attached to the results may make our vision too myopic, making us miss the opportunities ahead and losing enjoyment. Falling in love with your business and products may make us seem obsessive or desperate. Sales is a delicate process which may not happen without the right attitude. By being detached, we'll project confidence, independence, and professionalism, traits needed in closing sales and running a successful business. One of the hardest decisions you'll ever face in life is choosing whether to walk away or try harder. Ziad K. Abdelnour, Economic Warfare, Secrets of Wealth Creation in the Age of Welfare Politics. Keeping a personal scoreboard. The reason why creatives often have a hard time finishing a large project is because of our tendency to strive for instant gratification. Because there are no medals given at the end of every day spent working on the project, no reward for every page of the book written, we need to come up with our personal reward system to keep going and finish the lengthy process. Keeping score is one of the proven techniques that can motivate us to continue without being immediately rewarded. Keeping track of our daily scores is very gratifying. Being preoccupied with daily results makes us not think about the end goal and be dissatisfied when we think about how long it will take us to get there. We are focused on daily measures, keeping track of our performance and trying to break our personal records. Our scoreboard can have check marks, and we may be motivated to continue the chain and keep creating daily. The most important thing is not to break that chain, because once you skip a day, it'll be easier to skip another one. I met a yogi at the Shivananda Ashram in Kerala in India. When she told me she had been practicing yoga twice a day and hasn't skipped a day in 10 years, I asked her what her method was to be so disciplined. She said, "I never have the internal talk with myself if I should do the practice. I just do it." She transformed her yoga sessions into a regular habit, which became a rhythm. She didn't need to decide whether to practice. She was going consistently without having an internal debate. Eliminating the need to decide what time she should do yoga and where also contributed to being less prone to missing a day. How not to be a starving artist. Value of honest feedback. The reason why there's a coined expression, a starving artist, and not a starving accountant or a starving secretary, is because very often artists create things that nobody wants. The answer to the question of how not to be a starving artist is simple. Start making things that people want. I spent 3 years of my early adulthood living in France, and there, just like almost anywhere in Europe, people are more direct. Finding out what customers want and adjusting accordingly is crucial to decreasing the chances of being a starving artist. If the public in France doesn't like the piece, the artist may hear, "C'est de la merde." It's not uncommon to get the "it's shitty" in France. But such blunt critiques are seldom heard in America. European directness may help the artist who listens and wants to respond by improving and redoing their work. He'll succeed in having a likable style that sells. However, an American artist will be getting a lot of great, positive feedback expressed in a diplomatic way. He may continue creating, following his passion, thinking that his style or product is liked, yet not making any sales. He'll be on the wrong path, and there will be nobody to help him, direct him, or give him honest critiques. People in the United States are cautious about expressing their opinions. They don't want to hurt or discourage the artist by saying anything negative. During my career as a jewelry designer, my work has been rarely criticized. This was not proof that all my designs were impeccable and best sellers. There were pieces that were not selling. Especially at the beginning of my jewelry designer path, I had to decide on my own about the direction I would take my designs. There was one client of mine with a very successful store in Ireland who would sit with me during her NY visits, look at my new pieces and say things like, "Why is the butterfly crooked? You're trying too hard. Hang him straight." Or just